Hey, this is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream, Refuge Recovery, and Dharma Punks. Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. I hope you're enjoying the Dharma. Together, may we create a positive change on this planet. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes. May our paths cross soon. Welcome, everyone. Anybody here for the first time tonight? Welcome, welcome, welcome. Welcome back to everyone else. Welcome to anybody joining us for the first time online on the Zoom group. You can sit anywhere, any seat that's open, cushions if you want. I like to begin class by introducing a simple topic, kind of an icebreaker to get you to talk to each other in service of Against the Stream, this meditation group being a place where you can eventually build some community, get to know other people. It's a core foundation. It's a core part of Buddhism to associate with other people who are also practicing, to make friendships and associations and connections. It's called Sangha, taking refuge in Sangha. Sangha translates as community. And so I like to begin by asking you to talk to each other a little bit so that if you come here regularly, you'll build community, you'll get to know each other, and you'll have some Sangha, not just, it's hard in Buddhist meditation groups to meet people if you just come and meditate and then leave. So I try to facilitate you meeting each other. The topic tonight is mindfulness of the seven factors of enlightenment. And I'll go into that later, but I thought for the icebreaker, I'd give you this really terrible question, which is, what do you think enlightenment is? What's your idea? What would it be like to be enlightened? And so another way that we talk about enlightenment is to experience life without suffering about it at all. Zero suffering walking through life. Now, qualification, that doesn't mean zero pain, it doesn't mean zero loss and impermanence, and it doesn't mean zero difficulties. It just means having the skill to meet whatever happens with a wisdom and a compassion and a understanding, so that no matter how painful it is, you're not suffering about it, you're just experiencing the pain. No matter how pleasurable it is, you're not getting attached to it, you're not addicted to it. What do you think it would be like to be? What does enlightenment mean to you? What would that be like? And maybe you might even say, does it even sound desirable? Do you want to be enlightened? Do you want to experience that? Is that part of your motivation? Are you meditating so that you can experience total freedom from all forms of suffering? So that's the question. Small groups. Mindfulness is the seventh aspect of the Buddha's Eightfold Path, the eight aspects of practice that will lead to freedom from suffering, alleviating the unnecessary levels of suffering that we experience. There's four foundations of mindfulness. Those of you come on Mondays regularly know that we're at like several weeks, I don't know, 2 months, 3 months into going section by section through the Eightfold Path. I mean, the Four Noble Truths, four foundations, so many numbers, four of these, eight of those, four foundations. We're on the fourth foundation. I think we're on the fifth or sixth section of the fourth foundation. My sense is that mindfulness is, and maybe all of the Buddhist teachings are instructions, or are both instructions, how to meditate. This is how to train your mind. This is how to investigate, how to question, how to try to be present. Here's the technique. But it's also, and especially this fourth foundation of mindfulness, it's also a description. Like, so we could talk about the Four Noble Truths. There is suffering. There is a cause of suffering. It's possible to end suffering. Here's the eight places, parts of your life to practice with speech, with action, with livelihood, with mindfulness, with concentration, with effort, understanding, and intention. So they are instructions. But also, if you think about the Noble Truths, they're also a description. If you pay attention, you will see for yourself how you are at times suffering. And if you pay close attention, you will see, oh, my suffering is always created by craving for something to be different than it is, or resistance to something that is happening, craving and aversion, right? So it's not necessarily an instruction as much as a description of the human condition. The instruction is pay attention to the suffering, the causes of suffering, and then mindfulness as the intervention. Now, the first three foundations of mindfulness, where the Buddha says, now sit down to meditate and bring your attention to your body. Try to ignore your mind. Pay attention to the sensations of the breath coming and going, mindfulness of the breath. Pay attention to the body as the four elements. Pay attention to the body as these different anatomical parts, the 32 parts of the body. Pay attention to the impermanent nature of the body. They are all instructions on some level, but also it's a description. If you sit down and pay attention, you'll feel your breath. What do you, you know, what will you experience? If you had no instruction and you just sat here, you would feel your breath and you'd feel the sensations and you'd start to perhaps understand, oh, this is just the four elements. And oh, there's all of these, you know, skin, hair, nails, teeth, organs, the lungs are breathing, the heart is beating, the mind is thinking. So it's also just a description. The second foundation. This is a little bit of review. Second foundation of mindfulness. Now that you've paid attention to your body, investigate not only what's happening moment to moment, but what is the, how does it feel? In some ways, mindfulness is what is happening right now, what's happening. And second level, how does it feel? Whatever's happening, is it pleasant or unpleasant? And obviously, from what I was just saying, probably obviously, the reason there's so much emphasis on how does it feel is because we see almost all of our suffering is based on craving for it to feel different than it does, or resistance to the way that it feels. So the more we can bring awareness to how we're feeling, we can start to develop more tolerance for discomfort, more compassion for pain, more non-attachment to pleasure. Breaking that cycle of craving, that cycle of addiction, that cycle of I need to be comfortable in order to be at ease. I need to have pleasure in order to be happy. What a dead end that is. Almost all of us got ourselves sent to rehab chasing that one. Trying to chase pleasure as a source of well-being, trying to run from pain, it's a dead end. The third foundation, if you just sat here, description. If you sat here and paid attention, what would you see? You'd see thoughts arising and passing, thoughts arising and passing. So it's a, you know, the Buddha says, now sit here. Now don't ignore your mind forever. Pay attention to your mind states. Know when your mind is filled with craving or aversion or fear. Know it, name it, bring awareness to it. And then fourth foundation, where we're at this, I think we're at the sixth or aspect of the fourth foundation, which is translated as the Dhamma, which is truth. These guys, this text that I'm using from a Buddhist monastery in the Thai forest tradition, northeast Thailand, they translate it as mindfulness of the phenomena that is happening. And we went through the last few weeks, we went through mindfulness of the phenomena of, I think it was last year, I did last week. I did the six sense doors. The week before that, mindfulness of the five hindrances, those mind states of craving, aversion, restlessness, slothfulness, and doubt. tonight, the Buddha's instruction is be mindful when the enlightenment factors are present as a description. If you meditate regularly, eventually you'll come to a place where it's not all suffering in your mind. It's not all craving and clinging and aversion. You'll start to see that the mind is very mindful at times. You've trained your mind. You've become mindful. And so this is an interesting instruction. Be mindful when you're mindful. Know it. Oh, this is mindfulness. I'm present. Being present feels like this, much different than being distracted, than being in the future or the past. Being present feels like this. When the attention is gathered and we're concentrated, be mindful. Oh, concentration. I can direct my attention. I can choose to pay attention to something without getting drawn off into the other sense doors or into the mind's plans and memories. I've developed concentration. I'm focused. I'm present. And that with mindfulness and concentration, also mindfulness of, oh, the factor of investigation and discernment is here. I can direct my attention. I can question what I'm thinking and feeling and experiencing. I can investigate it. We can't always do that, but sometimes you're like, oh, I'm so present and I'm feeling these sensations or these emotions or these thoughts arising. And there's awareness that that's what's happening, and I'm questioning, I'm investigating. Investigation takes a lot of forms, but maybe one of the core encouragements in this meditation technique is investigate the impermanent nature of whatever is happening. See how it is arising, see how it is changing, see how it is passing. So with every sensation, investigate the impermanent changing nature of that sensation, with every emotion, with every thought. Oh, this thought is arising and it's playing itself out. It's what the Buddha called papancha. It's the mind is proliferating. That sort of like brainstorming, where you're just like letting whatever thought come. And if you just watch your mind, you'll be like, oh, my mind just thinks, and then that thought leads to that thought, and that thought leads to that thought, and that thought leads to that thought, and all of a sudden, you know, and then comes back and is repetitive. Or you ever find yourself in meditation and all of a sudden you're gone 5-10 minutes into some fantasy and you're like, what the fuck happened? I was here and then I heard a motorcycle and I started thinking about, I like motorcycles. I need another motorcycle. Can never have too many motorcycles. And all of a sudden I was buying a, you know, 1957 Panhead. And then I realized, oh, I probably can't kick it because my knee's fucked. If I get that Panhead, I'm going to have to get an electric start for it. And like 10 minutes later, I'm thinking about a Harley Davidson vintage bike. And what happened? I heard, I can track it back. Oh, the mind just fucking went, because I wasn't concentrated. I wasn't being vigilant. I was just sitting here, and that sound led to that series of thoughts, the proliferation of thoughts. And sometimes it doesn't even take a sound, just the thought comes and then they start free associating, planning, craving, remembering. So mindfulness of concentration, mindfulness of when we're in that place where we can investigate the impermanent nature. Mindfulness of when sometimes, and this is an interesting one that's on this list, because I feel like it's most people's initial goal in meditation, mindful of when the mind becomes tranquil, tranquility, collectedness, serenity. That happens sometimes in meditation. From a Buddhist perspective, it's not the goal. Did you know that? And I, you know, even people who've been meditating for years will be like, I had this great meditation. It was so tranquil. It was so peaceful. It is not the goal from a Buddhist perspective to quiet your mind. It's not the goal to have a, you know, tranquility. It will happen sometimes. It's very pleasant. In some places, the Buddha actually warns a little bit against it, because we can get so attached to tranquility. We can get so, there can be so much craving and clinging to tranquility, and nobody lives there all of the time. maybe not even an enlightened being, lives in tranquility. That's a temporary mind state. Later in the Buddha's life, he said there was a lot of turmoil in his community. There's a lot of drama. There was accusations. There was fighting. There was power struggles. Did you know that? Like, you kind of think about like, yo, if you have an enlightened Buddha around, you're going to behave. But apparently not. Even with an enlightened Buddha, his followers were fighting for power, were arguing all of the time, were some of them were trying to kill him. His cousin was like, I'm gonna fucking cap that motherfucker and take the power. I'm gonna be the Buddha. His cousin Devadatta. So probably his mind wasn't tranquil all of the time. What he said was, I don't suffer about any of it anymore. I don't take any of it personal. I don't suffer about any of it. But it's not like I'm walking around with a lobotomy. It's not like I don't have a mind and emotions and, you know, feelings. I still have a mind and emotions and feelings. I just have the ability to be at ease with all of it. Sometimes the mind is tranquil. Sometimes the mind is very busy and I don't suffer about that. Sometimes the mind is concentrated. Sometimes it's distracted and I don't suffer about that. Mindfulness, concentration, investigation, what I was just saying, tranquility. The fifth one is joy. And sometimes when you're mindful and joy comes, happiness, the Buddhist word is piti. It's often translated as rapture. And I don't know if you've had this experience yet. Some people meditate for tranquility, for serenity, for peace. Some people want the joy. And that happens too. Sometimes in meditation, you'll just be like, I am so fucking happy right now for no reason. I don't know if you've had this yet, but it's weird. Because usually we have a reason for being happy. Like there's some pleasure happening. There's something happening. Sometimes, especially in long-term meditation retreats, I've been sitting there just like smiling in this experience of joy going like, this is weird. Why am I so fucking happy about just sitting on my ass day after day after day after day? But it's because this awakening factor of joy, of piti, of rapture is part of what happens in meditation sometimes. It's not the goal. It doesn't last. Don't get addicted to it. You can't make it happen all of the time. I don't know how many of you are still chasing, you know, like your first bong hit, your first wine cooler, your first really pleasant meditation. I don't know if everybody's had them, but it's a really common phenomena in meditation circles where you have this amazingly pleasant experience in meditation. Then you spend the next 10 years trying to reproduce that and kind of craving for it and kind of suffering about like, I just can't quite get back to that first bong hit. It's just not the same, you know? Or maybe you do, maybe you revisit that place over and over, but I've known a lot of people who've spent a lot of time on the meditation cushion craving for an experience or to reproduce an experience rather than the goal is be with what is. Sometimes the mind is really joyous. Sometimes it's really concentrated. Sometimes it's really tranquil. What else is on the list? Equanimity. When you're here and you're experiencing equanimity, be mindful. Oh, this is what it feels like. Equanimity, by definition, is a balance and is a feeling of like, I care deeply about all living beings. I care about my loved ones. I care about the world. But I also have the understanding that I don't need to suffer about the way the world is, right? There's the compassion, there's the love, there's the feelings of empathy for the suffering in the world. But equanimity is also that feeling of like, everyone has their own karma. Everyone has you know, I can't control anybody else. I can't make anybody else be compassionate or wise or loving. So it's that caring with a non-attached. One of the other ways that equanimity is talked about is the vicissitudes of knowing that no matter how much praise you get, there will still be blame in your life. And having the same kind of sense of ease and well-being, whether people are speaking your praises or criticizing you. Hard, right? In the midst of criticism, to be like, okay, I hear you. I hear. And in the midst of like, you're the best, be like, I hear you. And not being too, you know, swayed by either pleasure or pain, praise or blame, gain or loss, fame or disrepute. Now our culture is based on chase pleasure, chase fame, chase praise, right? And probably your family of origin was conditional love when you, you know, will praise you when you, all of that stuff. And then Buddhism comes along and says, accept both, praise and blame. Have the experience of ease and equanimity in the midst of whatever's happening, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. I think that's only six. Which one did I forget? Let me cheat. Mindfulness invested, oh, energy, effort. Virya. Now, the definition of virya is diligent striving. But what it means is that I'm channeling my effort. I'm present. I'm using. Now, we're always using our effort. You know, we're always putting effort into something, right? We're always putting our attention somewhere. This, in this context, is, am I in meditation, putting my effort in a balanced way, in a striving but not uptight way, into being here, into seeing clearly? Am I trying? Am I putting effort, energy? And sometimes, like when you're really in the hindrance of torpor, you can be like, I just have no, I'm just, when you're in depression, you know, and you're just like, fuck, I just have no energy to be real present or clear, or just dull, just, you know, down or even sleepy. So in this section of the fourth foundation of mindfulness, the Buddha says, now in mindfulness, the description of what you'll see. You'll be mindful, you'll be concentrated, you'll have effort, you'll be able to investigate, and you'll have experiences of tranquility, and you'll have experiences of joy, and you'll have experiences of equanimity. And all seven of these are impermanent. They arise and they pass. They arise and they pass. Until very, very, very advanced levels of awakening on the path. And then maybe at some point you are able to maintain mindfulness all of the time, and you have an ease of concentration, and you have equanimity most of the time. The Buddhas, the enlightened ones, are experiencing this stuff a lot. The rest of us, fleeting. Ah, I had a moment of equanimity. It was amazing. I had a little bit of joy and I didn't cling to it. It was amazing. My, you know, just tranquility came and it went, impermanent, arising and passing, arising and passing. So that's what we're doing tonight. So we'll meditate. I'll give some instructions. That was all pre-game. Find a way to sit that's upright, that's relaxed. As you're ready, allow your eyes to be closed. Establishing mindfulness, awareness, present time, non-judgmental, kind, investigative attention. in your body. Feel your body sitting here. Spend the first 5 minutes just paying attention to your breath and ignoring your mind. Breathing in, feel the sensations of the breath. Breathing out, give your full attention to the breath. Each time the attention wanders back into thinking or somewhere else, just gently return to the breath over and over for 4.5 more minutes. One breath at a time. Mindfulness is present. Each time you feel the breath, you direct it. Some level of concentration, if you can feel 2 or 3 or 4 breaths in a row without getting drawn off. You can count the breath to see how concentrated you are. Can you get to 10? Without wandering off into the future or past. If you can get to 10, count backwards, down, 9, 8. The effort of connecting, sustaining, the effort of returning. So all these three aspects of the awakening factors, mindfulness, concentration, effort. Returning over and over to the breath, the effort of reconnecting or sustaining. Mindfulness of the breath. Investigating the breath for impermanence. How is it changing? Questioning, inquiring, where does the breath enter the nostrils? How does it exit? What's the temperature, the texture? Probably all four of these awakening factors are present: mindfulness, concentration, effort, and investigation. Just with mindfulness of the breath. mindfulness feels like this when we receive what's happening. We know the breath is coming or going. We know we're here, present, sitting, not lost in our plans or our memories. Thoughts are in the background, perhaps. Concentration feels like this when we can feel several breaths in a row. Perhaps being able to count the breath, not lose track, and you know, concentrated a bit. Investigating, inquiring, observing, interest and curiosity to the sensations, the rhythm, the beginning, middle, and end of each breath. Investigating the feeling tone of the breath. Is it pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral? Opening beyond the breath to include the whole body. Opening to the emotions, the sense doors, the thoughts. First, second, and third foundation included in present time awareness, what's happening in your heart and mind right now? Is there joy? Is there sorrow? Is the mind craving for this moment to be different than it is? And at times, as we open in this way, you will see that the mind settles, becomes tranquil. Not much activity, not much disturbance. that at times the mind, the heart becomes joyous, happy, the experience of rapture, sukha. Sukha is happiness born of mindfulness, born of wisdom. And if you're not experiencing joy or tranquility, what level of equanimity, of acceptance, self-acceptance, being at ease with the way things are, is equanimity, whether it's pleasant or unpleasant. Whether the mind is calm or quite busy. Last few minutes, I'll read to you the instructions as translated directly from Pali. The Buddha's words, as close as we can get, the Buddha says, here we dwell contemplating phenomena in phenomena in terms of the seven enlightenment factors. When there is mindfulness, when there is the mindfulness enlightenment factor, one understands. There is the mindfulness enlightened factor in me. When there is no mindfulness, one understands. There's no mindfulness enlightenment factor in me. One also understands how the unarisen mindfulness enlightenment factor arises and how the arisen mindfulness enlightenment factor comes to fulfillment by development. when there is the investigation phenomena, enlightenment factor, one understands. There is investigation of phenomena, enlightenment factor in me. Or there is no investigation of phenomena, factor present. One understands how it has arisen and how it passes. When there is the energy, effort, factor, one understands this is effort, energy. When there is rapture, joy, happiness, one understands this is the rapture, enlightenment factor. And when there is no rapture, one understands there is no rapture present. When there is tranquility, enlightenment factor, one understands there is tranquility. When there is no tranquility, one understands tranquility is not present. When there is concentration, one understands concentration is present in me. When there is no concentration, one understands there's no concentration enlightenment factor in me. When there is equanimity, one understands there is equanimity present, or there is no equanimity present. The last section of the instruction is, in this way one dwells contemplating phenomena and phenomena internally, or one dwells contemplating phenomena in phenomena externally, or one dwells contemplating phenomena in phenomena both internally and externally, or else one dwells contemplating in phenomena, its nature of arising, or dwells contemplating in phenomena, its nature of vanishing, passing, the impermanent arising and passing. And lastly, the instruction says, or else mindfulness that there are phenomena is simply established in one, to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and repeated mindfulness. And one dwells independent, not clinging to anything in the world. This is how one dwells contemplating phenomena in phenomena in terms of the seven enlightenment factors. I think it's useful to break this down into four and three. The first four, mindfulness, effort, concentration, and investigation, those four, you experience a lot, right? If you meditate. If you meditate, you're experiencing mindfulness, you know, you direct your attention. If you get a little bit focused, you can test your focus. Concentration is maybe a little bit controversial what it means. On one hand, the definition can be like, if you can count to 10, you're concentrated. And could you count to 10 tonight? I know when I started meditating, I could rarely count my breath to 10. I'd get to like 2 and then my mind would wander and then I'd be breathing in, breathing out, and then I start thinking about something else and I'd come back 1, 2, 3 and then my mind would start. So it's, you know, not everybody. It also depends on how much attention deficit, you know, you have. Some people are more settled, easier to focus the attention, concentrate it. But some level, some would say perhaps, you know, like when you're reading and you can read like a whole paragraph without losing your place, that's concentration. You know how sometimes you're so unconcentrated that you keep losing your place and having to read sentences over and over because you're reading it and then you get to the bottom, you're like, I didn't get any of that. I'm at the bottom of the page, but I was somewhere else. I don't even know what the fuck I just read. And you have to go back and reread it. That's not concentrated. So sometimes, you know, the definition for the kind of level of concentration we need for this kind of mindfulness meditation is just, are you present enough to read and, you know, understand, cognize, know what you've read? That's concentrated enough. That's one definition. Now, I say it's controversial because some Buddhists say you need to get so concentrated that your body disappears. You ever been that concentrated? Single pointed, they call it the jhanas. And you will have it sometimes if you meditate a lot and do longer and you'll have these experiences where you're so single pointed, so concentrated, all of the attention is gathered and all of a sudden you're like disembodied. And, or maybe there's just like tingling sensation or you just start to feel like energy and you're no longer identified with the physical form. And that can, so, but that's an extreme. That's an extremely concentrated state. It happens if you meditate a lot. But I'm more of a fan, especially for a group like this of mixed levels of experience, just concentrated enough to read, just concentrated enough to feel the breath, not dissolving the body, just feel the breath, count the breath, if you can count to 10 and then count back 9, 8, 7, 6. And you can do that up and down, sort of what we call ladder counting. You're very concentrated without getting drawn off into the thoughts of future and past. That's very concentrated. I can be with the breath and not get lost in thought. Very concentrated. That investigation of even just asking yourself, how is this changing? That kind of engaging the mind, thinking about the impermanent nature. How is it changing? Or as soon as we engage the second foundation of mindfulness and you ask the experience, is this pleasant, unpleasant, or neutral? That's investigation. That's the second foundation. And that's this aspect of an enlightenment factor. Anytime you're questioning your experience, you're investigating. It's that factor of enlightenment that is investigation. And the effort to connect, to sustain. Every time you find yourself lost in thought and you choose to return, effort. Every time you're here and you're able to stay here, there's some to sustain, presence. Oh, I'm here, I'm here. My mind's wandering, but I'm here. Some level of energy, some level of effort. So the first four, I think, are pretty common. We call them enlightened, right? So did you know that you're like, it's like you're almost there. You got four enlightenment factors happening in your meditation. And not just on the cushion, but throughout your day. When you're questioning authority, that's an enlightenment factor. Investigating like your suspicion when you're kind of like, is that true? When you're looking at your social media and you're like, this seems like a bunch of bullshit. That's an enlightenment factor. That is the factor of investigation. Now, when you're looking at your social media and you're believing what you see posted and you're feeling jealous and comparing yourself to them, not an enlightenment factor. That's when you're stuck in delusion. So these first four, I think, are not so uncommon. The next three to experience joy, not non-sensual, non-material. Now the joy, the rapture, might be very sensual, but there's not a sensual source. You know what I'm saying? There's no cause outside of you that's creating the joy. It's not some pleasant experience. It's not some great attention that you're getting. It's not, you know, somebody's flirting with you. It's not nothing fun is happening. Nothing delicious is being experienced. It's spontaneous. That experience of just the heart, the mind opening and experiencing happiness for no reason, no source other than your own being. Spontaneous internal source of rapture. Not because you're microdosing. That's not an enlightenment factor. Likewise with tranquility. Not as common. I don't know. How often does your mind settle and become tranquil? You don't have to answer that, but some people maybe never experience that, except for in sleep. Some people's minds are just always busy, the untrained mind. The Buddha likened the untrained mind to a wild monkey that's swinging through the jungle. He called it the monkey mind that is swinging to the future and swinging to the past and is in doubt and in fear and in craving and in aversion and in, you know, just swinging, you know, that's your mind, right? Monkey mind all over the place. Future, past, judgment, fear, craving, aversion, I, me, mine, branch to branch to branch to branch all day long. Rarely does the monkey just chill and be like, I'm fucking tired of thinking. I'm tired of comparing myself to everyone else. I'm tired of craving. I'm tired of, and just rest. Sometimes that image of is used of like, if you have a bunch of sediment in a cup, like a bunch of dirt, and you stir it up, that sometimes in meditation, even the concentration with the breath and the body and just sitting here for 30 minutes, the sediment starts to settle. And there's an experience of tranquility. All the dirt is still in there. It just settles. And that's part of what is being pointed to. And again, I don't know why I feel like this is so important, but I do, to point out over and over, it's not the goal of Buddhist meditation. It's not the goal of what the Buddha taught to become tranquil. That's not the goal. Maybe equanimity is much more, but to have a tranquil mind takes a certain set of circumstances. And it's a little bit of a rarefied to have that kind of tranquility. It's a meditative phenomena. The mind, you know, even the trained mind doesn't rest in that kind of tranquility. There's plans to make, there's, you know, there's things to do. The mind needs to be active. It's a useful tool that we have, this human brain, the mind. And it doesn't get to just rest in neutral all of the time. We've got to make our plans and our aspirations and our communications and our connections and be of service and use our life to, you know, we need to be thinking about that stuff in a skillful way, in a wise way. Not the goal to be tranquil all the time. It's one of the phenomena of meditation. It will happen. It's pleasant. It's enjoyable when it happens. It's not why we're meditating. Buddhist meditation is much more about wisdom and compassion. It's about equanimity. If we meditate enough, we'll be able to navigate no matter what happens. We'll be able to get attacked and not suffer about it. I mean, you know, criticized, judged. We'll be able to have some equanimity in the midst of conflict rather than I'm only happy when people are either leaving me alone or being kind to me. None of us get to live a life free from conflict. We're all going to have conflict in our life at times. And so the goal is, how do we show up? How do we meet whatever's happening? Equanimity, wisdom, compassion. Likewise, joy. You don't get to be joyous all the time. I'm sorry. I love this image that I don't think it's in the Theravadan Buddhist tradition. I think it's more of a Chinese Buddhist saying, probably a little bit Taoist influenced, that life is 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows. And that's like I asked you earlier, the life of enlightenment. Like an enlightened life is balanced with joy and sorrow. An unenlightened life has mostly sorrow, mostly suffering, not a lot of joy. Joy is very fleeting. But the wiser we get, the freer we get, then actually a balanced amount of difficulties and sorrows, losses, and joys. Could you imagine if you were joyous half of the time? Like truly, I don't know, maybe some of you are microdosing. You decided you needed to feel good all of the time. I like to talk a lot of shit about microdosing, sorry. So the first four, mindfulness, concentration, investigation, effort, not so uncommon to have the experience of tranquility, the experience of equanimity, and the experience of rapture, joy. It will come if you keep practicing. It's part of what happens on the path. It's part of a description of, you know, the Buddha says, you look at your mind, this is part of what you'll see. Joy will arise and pass. Tranquility will come and go. Equanimity will sometimes be present, sometimes not present. Isn't it interesting in the instruction where he says, know if it's present, but also know if it's not present? Not just if it's present, but also no equanimity today. Zero. Tranquility? No. Joy? No. Mindfulness of no joy? Yes. I am mindful that there is no joy. Oh, you know, there's an interesting instruction there that I'm not sure what to make of, where it says, mindful, you know, you're mindful that you're mindful. And then it says, mindful that the factor of mindfulness is not present. I'm like, wait a minute. If I'm mindful that I'm not mindful, aren't I mindful? Doesn't that count as mindfulness? I'm aware that I'm not aware. fucking aware. I'm putting that one in the, I'm mindful of not being, I'm super mindful of not being mindful right now. I don't know actually how that works. How do you be mindful that you're not mindful? Because by definition, it's like being mindful that you're in a delusion. Like when you're in a fucking delusion, by definition, you don't know it. You're just in it. It's a delusion. You think it's true. That's why it's a delusion. That's all I got. What are your thoughts, questions, comments, clarifications? At home, you can raise your hand in the reactions tab. Here, you can use your hand. Ryan, please.
I don't know. I just like what you said just about, like, we were talking about, like, where my head is. And, like, what I said is just say clearly. And I'm saying if you truly see clearly, like, you will see 10,000 joys and 10,000 sorrows. And you will see all of the mind states that are possible for a human mind to experience. I don't know, I just like find that deep and interesting, and like,
yeah. Now the only, and you, I like the definition to see clearly, and my own definition, I think we have to go one more step other than seeing clearly. It can be possible, and maybe, you know, you can see this in your own, I've seen this in my own life, where I'm mindful that I'm doing something unskillful, but I'm still doing it. You know, I'm seeing clearly that I'm lying, but I'm still lying. I'm seeing clearly that I'm, right, reacting, and I'm mindful of, like, I fucking hate you, and I'm really mindful that I fucking hate you. I'm so aware of how much I hate you. So, and there is a clear seeing, and maybe the definition, if we're really seeing clearly, then we won't act in those reactive, negative ways. So, but I tend to think, like, seeing clearly and responding appropriately, wisely. Not just seeing it, but also then if I'm seeing the karma of lying or the karma of hatred or the suffering of, you know, then I'm seeing it and I'm responding, I'm acting, I'm in a wise way, so that it's not just clear seeing. It's not just a detached observation of the suffering, but it's actually an antidote to the suffering. It's actually seeing it and responding in the way that will end suffering rather than just observe how much I'm suffering or how much harm I'm causing. Something like that. Please, Didi.
Just to touch on, like, being mindful or being mindful tranquil, like, my ego is very manipulative. And, like, so, I could trick myself and think, oh, look, I'm so tranquil, I'm so happy, I'm so mindful, but, like, my, just to touch on, like, how can I be mindful of the manipulation of me taking that?
I don't really know. I'll repeat it for the people at home. Like, that phenomena of sort of bullshitting ourselves in meditation. And he was saying, like, you know, the ego kind of getting involved in me, like, I'm so fucking mindful. I am extremely tranquil right now. Like, and just that sort of bullshit. I don't know what we can do about that other than you can just be like, hey, ego, no, this isn't tranquility. Like, you know, maybe it's that investigation, that humility and that not self kind of like, you know, that's saying I'm tranquil is not being, it's not the experience. And so we put a lot of emphasis on an embodied experience. And there's thoughts that go along with it. Like all of these instructions are know it. And so all of that is like, know it intellectually, but know it in your bones, have that insight of, and that ultimately it's wordless. Maybe the mind will acknowledge it, but it's the thought I am and the experience of the thought I am mindful of. I mean, that's the instruction that's being given. When you're mindful, no, I am mindful. When you're concentrated, no, I am concentrated. But the actual experience of knowing it is wordless. It's not the ego commenting on our experience. It's the experience itself. And so sometimes, I mean, likewise, sometimes I'll have that experience. So many people can relate to this, where you're sitting there meditating and then your mind says, you're doing really good. You're not thinking about anything. You're totally, totally doing good. You're killing it. No thoughts are happening. You're just, you got this. And like this inner commentary of the experience, you're like, oh wait, that's all thinking mind. I'm, you know, not that there's anything wrong with that, but you know, that kind of narration of the experience. Let me take a couple at home. Michelle, go ahead.
Hey, thanks for the talk. During the breakout group, we were talking about, I was talking about delusion and, you know, hatred, greed, and delusion, like enlightenment is it the total absence of that, or does it arise and then you become aware and then it, you know, you become mindful of it? Which is it?
Could everybody hear in here though? The traditional perspective is that enlightenment is the absence of greed, hatred, and delusion. That rather than meeting pleasure with greed and clinging and craving, we meet pleasure with non-attached appreciation. Rather than meeting unpleasantness with hatred or unpleasant people or situations with hatred, we meet it with compassion. Rather than, and delusion has many levels, but the simplest of the delusion of a permanent self, I, me, mine, self-centeredness, rather than taking everything personal, the delusion of I'm the little piece of shit that the world revolves around kind of self-centered delusion, or I'm the, you know, perfect narcissistic, you know, delusion. Free from that kind of delusion of taking everything so personal. It doesn't mean that those, as you know, my perspective with Mara, and it doesn't mean that there aren't negative thoughts and feelings and afflictive emotions that come, but there's no identification with I am in that greed or I am in that hatred. But it doesn't mean that, you know, there won't still be really unpleasant thoughts and feelings that arise through the heart and mind.
But freedom from delusion. All right, I'm down. Thanks.
Yeah. Yeah, freedom from delusion. Andrew, go ahead.
Hey, thanks. And that part that you read, so aware of phenomena, in phenomena, what's with the in, and then internally, externally. And I've heard a few people talk about this. I never got a straight answer that stuck with me.
Oh, you're not going to get one from me.
Oh, damn it.
Because I don't fucking know. It is a strange turn of phrase. Contemplating phenomena in phenomena. That's the phrase you're looking at, right?
In phenomena, and then internally, externally, internally and externally.
Yes.
And then without regard to cling, without regard to clinging, without clinging, clinging to nothing.
In this way, one dwells contemplating phenomena in phenomena internally. Contemplating phenomena in phenomena externally, contemplating phenomena in phenomena both internally and externally, or one dwells contemplating phenomena, it's arising, contemplating phenomena, it's vanishing, contemplating phenomena in phenomena, its nature of both arising and passing, or else mindfulness that there are phenomena is simply established to the extent necessary for bare knowledge and repeated mindfulness. Phenomena just means experience. It's in the experience that we're having, contemplating the experience that we're having, the mind state, the phenomena of joy is a mind state. It's a warmth in the chest. It's a embodied experience. It's not just a thought. So I don't know why, what it means, you know, I don't have a good answer of what it means to be phenomena in phenomena. This body is a phenomena. Maybe that's what I'm reaching here. I'm not going to give you a good one, but I'll reach for it anyways. You know, this body is phenomena, is an experience. The mind is phenomena, is an experience. And so it's the experiences being experienced in the experience of a mind. Phenomena in phenomena. I'm not sure, but something like that.
Appreciate it.
Yeah. In the room, there was a couple more hands. Yeah, Frank.
So bringing it back to the beginning of the class tonight about what is enlightenment, it seems that it's just not suffering, right? So that gives us a lot of latitude in life to experience all kinds of stuff. So the question is, I mean, I love that. It seems very doable and very human.
Yeah.
We could learn.
Yeah.
But then at what point does something become suffering? Right. I mean, because that's when you're kind of putting your hand in the fire.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it's because it seems a lot of times we bring up this idea of enlightenment as it's this rarefied, you know, sitting like that guy behind you in this heavenly kind of space. But to me, that isn't appealing. What is appealing is getting through life without literally suffering, you know, which is why I keep coming back here and learning this stuff. But I'm just curious, like, what is that boundary then of suffering and just experiencing life fully?
Well, we all, I get the question, but also we all know when we're suffering about life. The problem is that conflation that we have around thinking that if it's painful, I have to suffer about it, or pain is suffering. Now, that discernment that we have to start to develop and unpack of, no matter how enlightened we are, life is still going to be painful at times. And just because life is painful doesn't mean that you're doing something wrong. But when we meet, I think I said last week, or maybe I said it at the retreat I taught this weekend, that simple equation of pain plus resistance, aversion, equals suffering. So when we stop resisting, stop hating, stop resenting, then we just experience the pain of life. But it's easy to be like, well, shit, man, I wish my life wouldn't have so many unpleasant trees in it. I must not be very enlightened because I continue to have all of these difficulties come along. The only other piece comment that I'll give to you, Frank, is that yes, it's just living life, but it's like Ryan and I were discussing, it's seeing clearly as we live life and responding wisely, which means, you know, an enlightened life, we're not causing harm to others, we're not intentionally causing any harm to others. It doesn't mean we're not going to offend people sometimes. The Buddha, I believe, was an enlightened being, and he offended a lot of people because he told them that they were delusional about their religious beliefs. He told them that they were fascist, racist, sexist, homophobes. People don't like being told that stuff. And it offends people when you speak truth to their ignorance. But it doesn't mean that you're not harming, you know, I mean, you're not intentionally harming, but you're offending people. So that line between a life of not intentionally causing any harm, but not playing it so safe that you're not speaking the truth, politically, socially engaged with the ignorance of the world that we live in and pointing it out. Yeah. Maybe time for one more. Tyler, you got it. Last one.
Thank you. I have a two-part question. First is, what do you think it's like to be enlightened and go through life as an enlightened person? And do enlightened beings know that they're enlightened? And I'm like setting the Buddha aside in this particular example, but do Do enlightened beings know they're enlightened?
I don't really think about enlightenment very much. I mean, I talk about it a lot because it's my part of my job. But honestly, I don't really think about much about what it's like to be an enlightened being. It's not something that I, because I don't know. I mean, I know what the scriptures say, and I know what the Buddha said about his experience, and but I don't think about it a lot. I my Buddhism is much more practical about kind of moment to moment, day to day. Am I being kind? Am I being generous? Am I being forgiving? Am I being present? Am I being mindful and concentrated and investigating? And, you know, am I being equanimous with the waves of shit or joy or sorrow? I don't really think a lot about like perfect enlightenment. I keep it simple. And what I already said with when I was discussing with Ryan, that I think what it means is to see clearly and to respond wisely. That's what I think it means. I think that that's a good working definition. Those who are seeing reality, the impermanent nature, the impersonal nature of reality with open eyes and are responding in a way that's freeing oneself from suffering and also isn't intentionally causing harm to any other living beings. The second part of the question, I think that, yeah, for sure. If you're free from suffering, you fucking know it. You know it. You know why? Like, because it's such a radical shift from normal, you know, the first noble truth. All unenlightened living beings are experiencing suffering, repetitive craving, and not suffering all of the time. It's a mistranslation to say Buddhism is this kind of pessimistic, everyone's suffering all the time. It's not the teaching. The teaching is everyone's suffering some of the time. All unenlightened beings are experiencing some suffering, and you know it when you're suffering because it sucks. Some of us, you know, maybe some beings, and I even feel like this in my early life for myself, when suffering is all you've known, then you can get so used to it that you're not even really aware that there's an alternative. But once you start to experience some freedom from suffering, you really know, oh, this is so much better than that. Non-attachment is so much better than clinging. Compassion is so much better than hatred. Not suffering feels so much better than suffering. So the more free you get, the more enlightened you get, the more you know, like, oh, this is way different than self-centered, clinging, aversive mentality. This is not suffering, and I know it, and I appreciate it. And I'm not speaking from direct experience. as far as enlightenment.
I'm just killing it.
Yeah, totally. Just killing it. Yeah, killed it. It was a 45-minute meditation, and I just killed it in 10. We'll leave it there for tonight. It is 8:30. Couple of announcements. I have a day-long, I'm hesitant to even say this because I was made aware today. I have a day-long in a couple weeks on April 6th, and only 2 people have registered. So today I had this little aversive, I was like, fuck that, I'm canceling it. Because I want to go see, you're one of the two people that registered. It's like, no, 2 people. I was like, fuck that, Bad Religion and Social Distortion are playing that night. I'll just go to the show.
Okay,
in Las Vegas, I was invited. I'm just going to go to Vegas. No, I will probably still do this. I'll probably still do the show. I mean, I'll probably still do the day long, but I'm just saying that that's coming up. If you're planning to come, register so that I don't cancel it. If I don't get a handful of more registrations in the next week or so, I probably will cancel it if only a couple people are interested. There are 5 more spots for the weekend silent meditation retreat, May 12th through 14th. Is that right, Sebastian? 10, 11, 12. Cat's coming. May 10, 11, 12. There's five more spots available. Only five more spots available. If you want to come to this weekend retreat here in Los Angeles, urban silent meditation retreat, sign up before it's going to sell out pretty soon. Only five spots left. I do have a 9-day scheduled for late September through early October. I think it's September 24th through October or something. But we haven't opened that for registration, but we will. Fall 10-day, nine-night 10-day retreat coming in the fall. So we'll leave it there. Class is done by donation. Please be as generous as you feel like being. Consider a $20, $25 donation for a drop-in class. Consider becoming a monthly supporter of Against the Stream. Consider giving a big donation so that we can make more scholarships for the retreats. Consider this a worthy, if you consider it a worthy place for generosity, please practice generosity here. And we'll leave it there, dedicating the merit outward in all directions, sharing the goodness of our practice, of our discussion of the Buddha's Dharma with all beings in existence. May each one of us get as free as possible, see clearly, respond wisely. And together, may we create a positive change on this planet. Thanks for tuning in to the podcast. This is Noah Levine, founder of Against the Stream and Refuge Recovery. If you feel moved to leave a donation, there's a link in the show notes.